pleasant duty of a chairman or chairlady to introduce the speaker to the audience. But I think all of you know Mr. Mater so well that it's really hardly necessary for me to say anything. He's been a friend of the society for such a long time, and one of our beloved speakers, shall I say. It's many, many years ago since I first heard him speak myself, and I was so astounded at some of the wonderful sentences that came out that seemed to mean so much and did mean so much that I kept a little book of them. When I went to his lectures, I always added two or three more of these really precious sayings. So I think tonight, even if you haven't your little book with you, you'll find a lot of precious sayings that Mr. Mehta has for you. Mr. Mehta.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, whatsoever changes is subject to birth and death. What is the driving force behind change? The underlying mechanical power behind is activity or motion, rajas, as we say in Sanskrit. The underlying psychical power is desire. These two, motion mechanically, desire psychically, represent the driving force behind change. Tainted by inertia, stupidity, dullness, activity leads circumstantially and mechanically to instability, explosiveness, pain. Psychically, to suffering, dukkha, to use the Buddhist term. Sanctified by purity, activity leads circumstantially to stability and prosperity, psychically to happiness. Thus, man always treads some path or other, because he lives in a world, in a universe which is constantly active. And he treads some path or other, either as the sport of fate or deliberately and purposefully. One might say that there are as many paths as there are men. Broadly speaking, the path which interests us here is what we may call the religious path or the living of the holy life. Who are those who seek to tread the religious path? Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the seventh discourse, verse 16, that there are four types who seek him. One, the unhappy or afflicted. Two, the one desiring goals regarded as worthy in the worldly sense. Three, the one desiring wisdom. And four, the wise. Sri Krishna explains what he means by the wise. Those who are intent upon the ultimate essence of things, the ultimate reality. Those he calls the wise. And he seems to indicate that those wise ones are born with the longing for the ultimate. They are the beloved of the gods, if you like. But it's very interesting to note that the very first group which he mentions consists of the unhappy or the afflicted. Because what is it that moves most men out of the worldly path into the religious path? It is unquestionably dissatisfaction, frustration, suffering. Suffering which is material, which is emotional, which is intellectual, which is spiritual. We all know suffering in the ordinary sense of the term. Something which hurts. In the first noble truth of Buddhism, as it is stated in so many words, it is said that birth is suffering, decrepitude, death is suffering. To be associated or united with one whom one does not like is suffering. Not to be associated with one whom one likes is suffering, and so on. But do you think that that meaning of suffering is the one which is really implied in the teaching? Surely any person of character can face those things, take them in his stride, easily enough in many cases, not so easily in other cases. There is a deeper suffering than that. There is much deeper suffering than that. Suffering comes when man asks questions. Questions which he tries to answer from the standpoint of his worldly criteria and evaluations. And he finds that they don't answer the problems which he seeks to solve. Suffering comes when he discovers that certain answers which are given, whilst applicable in certain contexts, do not work in other contexts. Suffering comes when deeply cherished beliefs, corroborated by one's own experience, for a long time maybe, are finally shattered by a circumstance so provocative that they completely throw overboard all that the person thought and discovered was proof, was the stable, was worthwhile. But there are other forms of suffering too. Something even deeper. One has lived the good life. One treads the path, as one says. One studies. One meets the master. One progresses. One has realized deep things through the trained intuition which enables the person to have flashes of deep insight. And then there comes a darkness, a clouding over, and everything seems wrong, false. The way is lost. There is nothing under one's feet. There are no stars in the heaven to guide one. Deep spiritual distress, this clouding over of one's awareness of the transcendent, which seemed so bright and true previously. But this suffering is of the deepest nature. And added to it, there is one other suffering. One has sought the ultimate truths, and one has not been able to enter those profound modes of awareness where one's own consciousness is completely in harmony with those profound truths. One, in other words, is unable to tread the deep course in the innermost realms of being. And that type of distress can be understood only by him who has suffered it. So there are many types of suffering, and they all turn one to the religious path. Now this religious path, including the path of the yogi and the mystic, there are those who would like to separate them, but the separation is false. The religious path means a reversal of direction of movement. It also means a reversal of the ordinary or unwholesome human condition. The way leads to the perfect, holy human, enlightened and liberated. The way leads here now to the realization of true being, in which body, mind, and the transcendent, or if you like, things, the one, and the voidness, or if you like, samsara and nirvana, are a harmony beyond all speech and conception. The way leads a man to such insight that he will see his own original face or touch nirvana with his body, as the Buddha said, or experience the lifting up of his manhood into the Godhead, in Christian terms, or know again the glory he had with the Father before the world was, or, as in the Judaic tradition, see himself, his own self, face to face as the one of us created by the Elohim in their own image, immortal, essentially divine. That is the end of the way. Put it in other terms, the way leads man to his true home. It leads him not merely as errant, wayward man saved from sin, but as Lord of the universe, centered in the primordial that which is the absolute truth, the ineffable love and light and life. And what a homecoming is his, clothed in his shining Ogoides, as Greek religion taught, or in his Shekinah, as the Judaic tradition teaches, the divine light with which he is surrounded in his innermost being. This is the mantle which Elijah let fall upon Elisha. This homing path of the returning pilgrim may be regarded broadly in two sections. One, which we may call the preliminaries, such as verbal teaching, study, reflection, changes in the mode of living, purification, mindfulness, ordinary meditation. And second, the path of progressive illumination, or the inner path, which spells austerity, yoga, deep meditation, in Buddhistic terms, the jhanas and samapattis, the deep coursing, as it is called. What we have called the preliminaries must not be regarded as something which one deals with for a little while and then one has done with it. The preliminaries will come over and over again in subtler and profounder forms as one goes on and on. These simple preliminaries, verbal teaching, study, reflection, changes in mode of living, and more importantly, purification, mindfulness. If one is to extract the essence of this, one may put it in two words. Purification and contemplation, or meditation if you prefer the word. These are the two important things. Now, a reversal of the direction of movement implies the observance of a discipline. This discipline aims at bringing about this reversal of the human condition. The reversal of the direction of movement, the way we are going in our life, every day of our life, in the ordinary way. That has to be reversed, because that leads us away from this inward harmony. And the discipline which takes us away from that is a discipline which also brings about the reversal of the human condition. We witness the fruit of these reversals as a transformation of consciousness. And that is the story, the whole story of spiritual progress. Spiritual progress simply means a complete transformation of consciousness. Consciousness in the sense of our mode of awareness of our existence here and now. Supposing there was a busload of people moving along, and that bus stopped somewhere, and there was a crowd of people outside. In the bus is a clergyman. He is aware of that crowd of people, as so many souls to be saved. There is an estate agent. He is aware of that crowd of people, as so many people who will be needing houses or flats. There is a tailor in the bus, and he is aware of all those people, as so many people who will be needing suits. One is aware of one's situation in a particular manner, according to what one is, according to what one's desire is, one's interest, and so on. Now that is the manner in which we are conscious. It is our mode of consciousness. That has to undergo transformation, complete transformation. When the transformation has reached its peak point, the goal of spiritual progress has been attained. Now, the discipline has certain basic elements which may be summarized in one word, asceticism. This word is not in favor with the modern world, East or West. People don't like asceticism. This is the age of affluence, of plenty. We like the good things, we want the good things, and we think we are promoting good. Nothing can be further from the truth. It is rather a hard saying, particularly in our present period. But the point is, we must understand the true meaning of the word asceticism. Asceticism means the replacement of all that is unessential by all that is essential for realizing the goal. The question is, what are we interested in? If we want to become concert pianists, we practice 12, 14 hours a day. But if we practice a piano 12, 14 hours a day, what are the unessentials that we have to put aside in order to devote ourselves to the piano? That is asceticism. If you want to run a mile in 3 minutes, which nobody else has done yet, you will be running a great deal. You will not be eating or drinking this, that, and the other. You will not be dancing till 6 o'clock next morning, every other day, and so on. This is asceticism. If you want to obtain your PhD or DSc, well, you will study that particular subject to the exclusion of reading light novels, or whatever it may be. Some people, of course, need light novels in order to obtain a DSc. But then they are the exceptional ones. I, for one, have no such gift at all. I shall never get a DSc or a PhD. But asceticism means the putting aside of all that is unessential for the goal. That's all. Now, this replacement of the unessential by the essential is the root meaning of purification. Purification is a continuous process because the condition of purity, the state of purity of the individual, has to be continuously maintained. Otherwise, there is no point in attempting to tread the path. Let us look at the elements composing this purity. According to Zarathustrian tradition, summed up very shortly as good thoughts, good words, good deeds. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, there are the commandments. The Hindu teachings have what are called the yamas and the niyamas. The Buddhist teachings have the silas and the paramitas. It might be helpful, or at any rate interesting, to look at a list of some of these. Let's just take the Hindu and the Buddhist. The Hindu yamas, there are 10 yamas, 10 niyamas. Non-hurting, truth, non-coveting, continence, kindliness, equanimity, patient endurance, firmness of mind, moderate eating, purity. Those are the 10 yamas. The 10 niyamas are austerity, contentment with what comes easily. Modern world of affluence, take note. The third one is belief in the merit or demerit of actions. Charity, worship of Ishvara, a personal god. Sacred study, that is to say, study of the scriptures. Conscience. They express it as a sense of shame at wrongdoing. It's a literal translation of kri. Faith. Then, the repetition of prayers, which are words of power, mantras, either spoken aloud or silently. And the silent repetition of prayer, which is a word of power, is considered 1,000 times more effective, not 999, 1,000 times more effective than that which is spoken aloud. And lastly, the observance of the scriptural injunctions. Those are the 10 niyamas. Now, those of you who have also studied the Christian presentation, you'll remember that Christendom presents this type of thing as the external instruments of grace. All the great religions have these external instruments of grace or salvation or redemption. They all have them. Look at the Buddhist, the five sila, you know, to refrain from onslaught on creatures, taking what is not given, from incontinence, from wrong speech, and from intoxicants. The paramitas, charity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, forbearance, truth, resolute determination, friendliness, even-mindedness. Now, all these come under preliminaries, but they also belong to the deeper stages. How? Why? Let us look for a few moments at the deep meaning of the silas. Take the first two. To refrain from all harming. What are the implications? In the Judeo-Christian tradition, and the Zarathustrian too, we have this plain statement, thou shalt not kill. But that is the extreme case. Not to harm any living creature. Either in thought, or in word, or in deed. The implications are tremendous. If one takes the trouble to look into one's own life, one's daily life, one will catch oneself constantly harming. Harming not merely others, but also oneself. Take the next one, the other one, to refrain from taking what is not given. We are constantly taking what is not freely given to us by virtue of the drive of our own desire. These things have to be looked into very, very carefully with a quiet mind. Why do you think all the great teachers of the religions spoke about simple things like refrain from harming others, taking what is not given and so on? One would have thought any person with any social sense at all would observe these things. How does an animal live? The herbivorous animal eats plants without asking plants their permission. The beast of prey pounces upon another animal and slays it, hurts it, without thinking. But the animal lives according to the law of his own being. He has no power of choice. But man has a power of choice. He has to think. He has to distinguish. And if one looks into life carefully, one will see how very difficult it is to refrain from harming, to refrain from taking what is not freely given. It marks a tremendous gulf between the animal state of existence, the purely animal state of existence, and the human state, the truly human state. How many human beings in the world are there who do live without harming, or without taking what is not freely given? It would be very hard to find them, very hard indeed. So the great religious teachers taught these simple things. But we have not begun to appreciate the profundity of those teachings. That's why these silas are so important, these simple moralities. And they play their part in our purification. Not merely an external purification, but an inward purification, because thereby we become free from the fetters of greed and all its brood, hate and all its brood, and illusions and delusions from which we all suffer. The observance of the simple moralities in their perfection brings about such results. Now, in order to see into the simple moralities deeply enough, naturally, there comes up the question of the mind itself. We don't see because, one, we don't try to see, and next, because we haven't got the capacity to see. We think we are all very clever people, we are so intelligent or so intellectual or whatever it may be. We are quite mistaken. We are merely conceited, sometimes charmingly, sometimes not so charmingly. That is all. That's the fact of the matter. We are merely conceited. It is very necessary, therefore, to understand the importance and place of the mind, this thing we call the mind. You all know the first two verses of the Dhammapada. All mental states have mind as their forerunner. Mind is their chief, and they are mind-made. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, then suffering follows one, even as the cartwheel the hoof of the ox. On the other hand, if with a pure mind one speaks or acts, then happiness follows him close, like his never-departing shadow. Let us look at that again. All mental states have mind as their forerunner. Let me suggest that instead of mind, think of it in these terms. All mental states have mode of awareness or state of consciousness as their forerunner. All mental and emotional states, all words, all actions are the external representations in the manifested world of one's mode of awareness, which is formless. Man is a living being who is a conscious being. In what manner is he conscious? What is his mode of awareness? That mode of awareness is expressed mentally, emotionally, in speech and in action, as our mental states and our thoughts, our feelings, what we say and what we do. So all mental states have mode of awareness as their forerunner. This mode is their chief, and they are the consequences of the mode of awareness. As I said earlier, the whole story of spiritual development and progress is a transformation of the mode of awareness. How are we aware of existence? This is the crux of the thing which leads to awakening to enlightenment. We become aware in a different way, and therefore come out of the darkness into the light. Now, there are those who like to say that any physical object is a projection of one's mind. Now, if this physical object is a projection of my mind, why can't I deproject the mind and make the physical object disappear? How does this continue to exist when another person is present? How is it possible that the projection of my mind should be exactly the same as the projection of everybody else's mind? Personally, I don't feel happy with that sort of statement, that matter is the projection of one's own mind. One's own mind, that is the point. But supposing we chose to say that everything which we call material is concretized mind, the universal mind, all right, that statement could stand logically, could stand analysis. This is no illusion. It is concretized universal mind, if you like. Put it that way. But if you say that, then you must also equally grant that mind is subtilized matter energy. If you have six of the one, you have to grant half a dozen of the other. But the point of this comes here. There is a continuity. There is a wholeness. What we have chosen to call and regard as matter on the one hand and mind on the other hand is really one great whole. But we have lost the linkage. We are in a state of confusion, of unenlightenment, and therefore that which we call mind and what we call matter remain divorced, remain uncoordinated, they remain in a state of disharmony. Now this is due to that element which we choose to call, and not wrongly, our own minds. What is this itself? The individual person. Not body and mind. But he is a complete whole, just as everyone else is. But this patterning of the universal mind, which is my mind, this particular pattern, being impure, being confused, being deluded, introduces the disharmony between the universal reality of the universal mind and the universal reality of universal matter energy. I am the cause of the disharmony. My mind. You see? Now what happens in the course of evolution? We see rocks, stones, perfect in themselves, the sea, the stars, the earth, trees, flowers. But none of these things cognize themselves. Then come plants which begin to show the capacity for a delayed response. Plants like the Coelenterata and so on. As this kingdom develops and becomes more and more complex, and the power of delaying a response becomes greater and greater, the power of choice increases. And here are the primordial origins of the development of what we ordinarily recognize as our own mind. So Mother Nature makes this body with a nervous system and a brain and so on, and we human beings have developed sufficient elements of mind to possess an instrument of self-cognition. This is very important. Our minds are instruments of self-cognition. I don't know whether a highly intelligent dog or a horse has the power of self-cognition in the way that you and I have the power of self-cognition. But I think we can all agree with certainty that a stone, for instance, a lump of earth, has no power of self-cognition. Now, possessing minds as we do, this pattern, which, though confused and impure, nevertheless is capable of looking outwards and see the world and objects in the world, and also look inwards and see principles and laws underlying the external pattern of things. This mind of ours can do all that sort of thing. But it cannot correlate what it calls, on the one hand, the great spiritual values and transcendental reality with the manifested world. It can't correlate it. The fault is ours. Our minds are impure. They are like bent mirrors or dusty mirrors, not good reflectors of the reality. Now, reconsider the idea that this is concretized mind, this object, this physical object is concretized mind. If what we call the physical is concretized mind, then there is a link. The mind which has no cognition, the confused, not very pure mind, which has the beginnings of the power of self-cognition, and the universal absolute mind, which is all cognition. You have a wholeness, a continuity there, all the way through. You see? So that this mind of ours is the link between the manifested world and the transcendent, between samsara and nirvana. Hence the importance of the purification of the mind, the understanding of the mind and the purification of the mind. And this perhaps was the great triumph of religion in past centuries. But so long ago, there arose those great yogis and mystics who penetrated into the mysteries of mind, who are capable of transforming this impure mind into pure mind. Now, because our minds are confused, impure, therefore nirvana remains hidden, and samsara is experienced as suffering, as dukkha. Otherwise, samsara would not be experienced as dukkha. When pure and clean, when our own minds are pure and clean, then through our own minds, nirvana is reflected perfectly in our samsara. Please remember the stress is on our samsara. The Buddha found nirvana. The great religious teachers, the great Jivan Muktas, the great Arahats, the great Bodhisattvas, they knew the ultimate reality. They experienced nirvana. But millions of others did not experience nirvana. Any one of us may experience nirvana, but that doesn't mean that every one of us here experiences nirvana. But even when any person's mind, what is called his own mind, is pure and clean, then through that mind, nirvana is reflected in his samsara. Now, purification is moral and intellectual. Virtues and vices, what we call virtues and vices, are the patterns of expression of our psychic energy. That is what they are. The ill patterns spring from greed, hate, and delusion, as you all know, with your study of Buddhism. And so we have to get rid of those things. Intellectually, we have to become free of bias, prejudice, preconception, and assumption. These are the things which make intellectual dis-ease. Bias and prejudice, preconception and assumption. As we tread the path and reach nearer and nearer to that ultimate reality, to pure cognition, we discover that all our assumptions and preconceptions have no warrant in truth. Now, for purification, meditation is the supreme aid. And the key to meditation, of course, is mindfulness. Mindfulness which has to be practiced all through the day. 24 hours of the day, even in one's sleep. You might ask, well, how does one do that? You try and you will succeed ultimately. Then you won't need to ask me, how do you do it? But you start off whilst you are awake. And you will soon discover that you are able to continue it in your sleep. Then you might perhaps discover that very often when we say we are awake, we are more asleep than when we are bodily asleep. Mindfulness carried out in perfection becomes the concentrated attentiveness which is called ekagrata. One-pointedness it is translated. But I would personally prefer to call it one-mindedness, rather than one-pointedness. It's one-mindedness. Now, what happens with our minds? Confused, impure. Our minds are split up into 1,000 unrelated fragments. An interest this way clashes with an interest that way. An idea in this direction clashes with an idea in that direction. There is no wholeness. There is no coordination, no harmony. A healthy body has all its organs cooperating with each other to perfection, a truly healthy body. Same way with the mind. All the elements of the mind, all the mental organs, shall we say, should form one great harmony. Now, very briefly, our ordinary mental life is a conglomerate of a visual consciousness, an auditory consciousness, a tactile consciousness, and so on. The five senses, as we call them, associated with the five consciousnesses. The five consciousnesses associated with the five senses and their functioning. Now, over and above them all is what we call mental consciousness. And I remember a few weeks ago, the Dalai Lama saying to me, this mental consciousness is the thing through which the link with the purest essence of mind is maintained. The importance of this mental consciousness. Now, what is this mental consciousness really? It is the power which we have of directing our attention to anything. We may be looking at an object, but if our attention is not given to it, we might as well not be looking at it. We don't see it, as we say. Or, if our attention is abstracted and we are thinking of something else, as we say, we may hear a whole symphony may be performed and we don't hear it, and so on. This mental consciousness is the key. This power of directing attention. And the most important element in the treading of the path is the development of the power of concentrated attentiveness. Now, concentrated attentiveness is attained first through the pacification of the senses. When the senses are pacified and the burning, feverish drive of desire animating every sense is cool, then the senses are pacified. They are not suppressed, they are not repressed, otherwise there is disease again, physical and mental. They are pacified, brought to a state of harmony. They are at peace. And when they are brought to that state of harmony as a whole, all of them, the five of them, then there is that, the right condition prevails for entering into such a concentrated attentiveness that one has realized one-mindedness. Now, in the state of one-mindedness, one becomes aware of the fundamental, essential nature of things. Then our awareness, our mode of awareness of our whole existence, of the whole world, is completely and utterly transformed. All that we knew before is seen as no knowledge, or at best, absolutely childish, kindergarten stage knowledge. It is the veil over the truth. But in the state of one-mindedness, in full concentrated attentiveness, when all this continuous delusive variety has quietened down, then the single reality of existence is experienced. Now that state is the state in which one has made the ascent or descent, if you like, into nirvana. In that state, samsara and nirvana are one. Because there is no longer a confused, impure mind to spoil the perfect relationship between nirvana and samsara. They are one and the same thing. One and the same reality. In the meditative process, there are three main aspects. The Brahma Viharas, as they are called, the divine residences. Buddhism has, at least one aspect of Buddhism, has no place for self, as it says. It has no place for a divine being, as it says. But you will neither escape the self nor the divine being. Do what you like. In not trying to escape the self or the divine being, you will be free of the shackles of the self and the divine being. These are all vritti, transformations of the mind. The thoughts which we raise up because we are in a confused and impure state. The Brahma Viharas, the divine residences. What is the heart of the divine residence? In one English word, love. We call it metta, friendliness, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, altruistic gladness, taking joy in the joys of others. I would suggest that this has to be seen with good sense, taking joy in the joys of others. If you see 1,000 people jiving away like mad, well, I don't know what you'd feel, but I certainly do not take joy in that joy. Taking joy in the joy of others. I think what the Buddha had in mind was something like this. Taking joy in the fact so-and-so has taken another step to enlightenment. There's real cause for joy. When Hitler, who was blinded and near death in the First World War with poison gas, was cured by a doctor, I dare say his parents were filled with joy. But afterwards? So, taking joy in the joys of others. That's part of love. And finally, the Buddhist teaching is quite extraordinary here. Upekkha, even-mindedness, as part of love. Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras also has that. And actually, the teaching of the Brahma Viharas is anterior to the time of the Buddha. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. Why even-mindedness as part of love? Love rejects nothing and nobody. It is impossible to reject nothing and nobody unless one has complete even-mindedness, complete poise of mind. Any disturbance in that poise and we inevitably reject something or somebody. And that is hateful, that is unloving. Therefore, the bhikkhu, or he who wishes to tread the path, suffuses himself and others and so on with even-mindedness. It is part of the Brahma Viharas. And this is also described as the path to union with Brahma. Union with Brahma. The Buddha himself says that. Brahma, God the Father. Straightforward, pleasant, nice, divine being, and no nonsense about it. The second aspect of the meditation practice consists of the dissolution and transformation of the vasanas. I don't know to what extent in the southern canon, in the southern school, in the Pali canon, this is stressed. Very briefly, it is along these lines. When one has reached a state of calm and poise in meditation, one calls to mind deliberately events, situations of the past. Sees them exactly as they are, exactly as they took place. Sees them without attraction, without aversion, without praise, without condemnation. Seeing all the elements which compose that situation or event in that way, and learning to maintain complete even-mindedness, one accepts the totality of that situation. And in the acceptance of the totality of that situation, all the locked up, the distorted, diseased psychical state within one's own being is completely liberated. There is freedom. This is psychotherapy in the grand sense of the word. This is the real psychotherapy. You don't rely upon anybody else. You can't if you want to tread the path. Because somebody else's legs do not move you. Your legs move you. You have to stand on your own feet. You've got to do the job yourself. If you are hungry, you do the chewing and the digesting. However much you may eat pre-digested pap. You have to do it. So, this is one aspect of it. The dissolution and the transformation of all those locked up mental impressions. Now, not only the emotional states, but thoughts, beliefs, ideas. As and when you enter the deep course of meditation, if you get past or parallel with the great jhanas, if one ever even dimly feels or experiences the samapattis, what is called entering upon and abiding in the plane of no-thing. No-thing, not nothing, of no-thing. In that condition, the whole host of images, etc., and so-called spiritual influences which have affected one's own mind and nature, God, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, the angels, the Trinity, the everything, all that dissolves away. All that is seen to be a construct of the mind. And in terms of absolute reality, it has no warrant. But in terms of relative truth, it has every warrant. Because without all that, we could not get there. I've never yet met the person who, immediately after he was born, walked and talked and lived just like you and I do. Couldn't. You need help. You need all these stages. So they are valuable, but they are only stages. In the deep states, all these dissolve. So these are also the vasanas which one has to get rid of in order to reach that central heart of nirvana. And this also leads to even-mindedness. Because when the mind, the stuff of the mind within oneself is completely freed of all these knots, as put in the Upanishads, when the knots of the heart are liberated, heart not meaning the emotion.
That's right.
The wisdom meditations, seeing that everything is impermanent, everything manifested, every pattern which comes into being, everything which belongs to the limited and the particular, is not the ultimate reality. It is just a changing, passing form of it. It's a transformation. It belongs to the realm of becoming, and the realm of becoming is the realm of death. But that from which the realm of becoming emerges is everlasting life, is the transcendental reality, is the eternal, the absolute. Call it void if you like. But rather than void, say it is the voidness which is involved in manifestation, the non-void. And the wisdom meditations develop maha prajna, the supreme insight, just as the Brahma Viharas develop maha karuna, the supreme compassion. So, the ascent to nirvana through the jhanas and the samapattis, effected by him who has become the embodiment of maha karuna and Mahaprajna, is achieved. He is the one, the perfected Holy One, who has reached home.